It's Monday. You know what they say, don't buy cars that are made on Mondays and Fridays, because sometimes the hosts, and by that I mean the employees at the car factories, don't always have their head in the game. On Mondays and Fridays, they're thinking about the weekend, so that leaves you Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays. Hi, it's John Williams. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. 1209 on WGN Radio. We'll be here until 1 o'clock. Our first guest, Elise Glink, who knows a thing or two about real estate. She knows a thing or two about effective, efficient workplaces. Do you know much about car factories, too, Elise? Is that adage true, I wonder, Mondays and Fridays are the bad days?
I have no idea. I am such a non-car culture person, so I really don't know.
I've heard that said before, but then that only leaves you 3 days in the middle, and frankly, there have been some Wednesdays where I wasn't really on my game either, so the opportunity to buy a car for me is getting smaller and smaller. The $600 weekly unemployment boost is out over the weekend, technically. A lot of conversation on the radio today about the fact that it looks like the Congress is not in a mood to reinstate that as much as they are the $1,200. Is that the way you're hearing it?
Yeah, the New York Times just came out with a latest update about 10 minutes ago saying that the Republicans are going to slash the expiring jobless payments of $600 a week and replace them with something that looks to be around $200 a week, with the goal of getting the states to replace 70% of income. And that's actually an interesting number, John, because the 70% is at the high end of what you would get for disability insurance. If you are out for long-term disability, that's typically set between 60 and 70%.
But I'm sorry, you would get your unemployment benefit, that is, whatever your unemployment insurance would normally pay, and then you would get an additional, say, $200. So you would, that's the end of that in terms of unemployment benefits, right?
That's pretty much it, and they're not looking to extend it any further. So what had originally happened is that you got whatever your state would mandate, and then it was extended also by another 13 weeks. So that doesn't seem like it's in part of the plan, this extending it. We're also not seeing anything about student loans and how what's going to happen after September 30th, which is when the whole you don't owe anything, we're not charging you any interest, nothing's getting added to those federal loans. All that expires on September 30th, and we're not seeing anything about that either.
There's nothing in the bill that considers the amount of money the person was earning. So many people were talking on the radio today about the fact, and Ted Cruz kept this conversation going on Sunday, that some people were making more money with the unemployment benefits than they were with their salary. And so it was a disincentive to go back to work. He said 68% of the people fell into that category. I'm not sure what the number is, but I understand the point. You would think that it would be simple enough to simply say that you can't make more money on unemployment than you were before you were employed, before you were unemployed.
You know, I think that this is such a red herring. Yes, it's true. Some people were making more. They did it fast. They weren't thinking it through. So, yes, some people have gotten more. And a lot of those people particularly were at the low end of the pay cycle. So that actually was good, because those are the people, the lower half of America's, you know, when they get extra money in their pocket, they go out and spend it. They don't invest it. And so we need that for our economy. But the whole idea that people will stay home instead of taking their jobs is such a red herring, because, hello, they don't have enough jobs right now. There's 32 million Americans who are unemployed. And there are roughly about 6 million jobs being advertised as being open. And by any stretch of the imagination, that math just doesn't work. So what they're trying to do is put pressure on schools and other places to open up so that there will be jobs for people to go back to. But the whole thing just doesn't quite work for me.
It's a fascinating call we took from a woman who told me what happened with her stimulus or her unemployment benefits and what she was doing with it. I'll finish that story in just a minute. She called in earlier, and if you were listening, you know the story I'm about to tell. Elise Glink joins us here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, the real estate and financial wellness expert. Visit thinkglink.com. Elise, a woman called earlier today, and she had been working so little at her company, like one day, half a day. She was making $72 a week. And when COVID hit and she got laid off, she said, well, I don't think it's worth my while filing for unemployment. And her boss said, oh, you know, you've worked here for 12 years. Even though you're down to half a day now, you've earned it. Take your unemployment. She got $72 a week in unemployment. But because of the bonus, she got $672. She was making $72 a week. Now she's getting $672. Her husband makes $100,000 a year. So she's been saving the money and has $10,000 in the bank for a trip she's going to take when they get to travel again. That's not the way unemployment insurance works for most families. That'll be money in the economy at some point, but you can understand why Ted Cruz is upset about something like that.
I can understand it, but, you know, there are, I could give you 1,000 other examples of people who are, you know, bartenders and struggling to pay their rent and are worried about whether the foreclosure or the eviction moratorium is going to be extended because they are the only people who are, you know, earning any money at all. So good for that woman, and I'm glad she's saving it, which, by the way, is one of the big trends that we've seen. At all ends of the income spectrum, people are saving tremendous amounts of money. They're putting every single dollar they can towards paying down debt, deleveraging, as we call it in the finance world, and trying to build up that emergency fund because so few people actually had any dollars at all available just in case of, pandemic.
People do have some money on the side, too, because they're just not spending money the way they would. I was in Target over the weekend looking for one specific thing they didn't have, but I was shocked at how, I don't know how Target's doing on the recovery, but there's nothing to buy there. Like, the basic essentials are at Target. But Target's always been a fun store. Its shelves have been pretty well stocked. Now there's vast areas where stuff just isn't, and some of the shelves are kind of empty. It's amazing how bad a Target store looks right now.
Well, the same thing is true when you go to Costco, which is the only place I find myself shopping, that and an occasional trip to a pharmacy. But there are large shelves that are just empty, which is really interesting that, you know, we're seeing that. Whereas if you go online, there's lots of things available that aren't actually in the stores. And it makes you wonder if stores like Target and, you know, even American Eagle, which is also seems to be doing okay, Costco, if they've just shifted it more and more to online or into their warehouses in order to make it easier for people to buy.
Funny, though, because I needed that item today, right? So I get your point, and maybe it doesn't matter in the long run as long as you spend money at Costco or Target. But I didn't spend money at Target because they didn't have it, and I didn't want it in 3 days. I needed it in 2 hours, so I had to find an alternative way to buy it. Google is working from home until next July, huh?
Yeah, this is interesting. So that news came out yesterday afternoon, or maybe it was early this morning. Who can remember anymore? But they've made a stand. You know, they were the first ones to say that they weren't going to send anybody, they weren't going to have any traveling through the year. They weren't going to send anybody back to the office till 2021. And today they've updated that with news that they're not going to welcome their employees back to the office until July of 2021. And it makes me wonder, since they're so deeply involved in data tracking, what they know or what they think they know about the spread of coronavirus and when we're going to get it under control.
It's a good point. If Google's not going back, what does that say about the rest of us? And if Google's not going back, that means those people are going to be working from home, which means if they've got kids, they're going to have to figure out how to navigate that. This whole school thing is really coming to a crunch point, isn't it?
It is. This week is back to school for Georgia schools, so we're going to get an early taste of what that looks like. It looks in Georgia like, and they're going county by county, that the private schools are seem to be opening up in person, at least partly. Some of the public schools, depending on counties, are not opening up, and some of them are trying to open up. And it's going to be a petri dish for all of us to look at under the microscope to see what's working and what might work for Chicago and other major metropolitan areas.
It's not to say that it can't. I mean, I hate that phrase, petri dish, but it's probably apt. But it's working in Europe so far. some of the...
Right, but they've got it under control. Yeah. We don't have coronavirus under control to the extent that Europe does. I think they're under 500, I don't know if it's new cases or new, you know, I don't know what. They have so many fewer cases than we do with a larger population than the entire United States. So they shut down hard and early, and they are starting to see some resurgence, but nowhere near what we have going on here in the U.S.
Yeah. In light of the pandemic, people are assessing what their financial situation is, and the definition of wealthy is now... What's the number? $2 million?
This was sort of interesting. So, you know, every year there's a different survey out that takes a look at how wealthy you are and how does that compare. And it was sort of interesting because we always think about wealthy being somebody like a Jeff Bezos, right, whose wealth I think grew over the weekend at $13 billion in a weekend because his stock has, you know, been taking off. But it's interesting that for the rest of us, Americans now say an average net worth of $2 million is necessary to achieve the status of quote-unquote wealthy. And that's actually down 23%. And so the question really that I had for that is why is it that we think less money is actually more money when we're seeing more and more numbers that are so big? And I know, John, most people today don't consider themselves anywhere near wealthy. They're just terrified about going hungry.
The bar to be considered wealthy has been lowered to $2 million of average net worth, down 23% from January. So, yeah, you would think it would be going up, but it's actually going down.
Right. And it's in this whole idea of what it means to be comfortable. You can see signs of it changing on the ground. And I'll start with housing, which for the vast majority of Americans, housing is the biggest part of your net worth. It's how much cash you actually have is the equity in your house. And so, you know, when you think about housing, you think, well, the earlier, I've always been a big proponent of this, you know this because I write about, you know, real estate all the time, but the earlier you are in your life when you buy your first house, the wealthier you'll be later in life. What's very interesting to see right now is that multi-generational households have moved to the forefront, and you're seeing more and more buyers include a place where they can have either elderly parents or adult children live with them. All three sets of families qualifying for larger mortgages and larger properties. And so there's this, it combines a bunch of trends that we're seeing now, which is moving from the city to a bigger place in a suburban area all over the country, not just in Chicago, and then multi-generational people wanting to live together. And it's just fascinating to see how that's just changed dramatically, even over the last year.
It makes quarantining with family members all that much more complicated. The Sunday page one story in the Chicago Tribune was about Chinese Americans in Chicago from Chinatown. They had a reporter reach out to all 150 or so of the restaurants that live in Chinatown and ask them how they are doing. And remember, when coronavirus first hit, people were afraid to eat Chinese food, let alone go to a Chinese restaurant. Well, actually, per square mile, Chinatown is a safer place to be than plenty of the swell and not so swell neighborhoods in Chicago. And yet there they are, this vestige of coronavirus fear. People aren't going to their restaurants as a result. And it turns out this is a population that is very interested in being very safe because they tend to be multi-generational homes. I never thought about that, Elise.
Yeah, it's very, really a concern, especially when you've got elderly family members living with you. And I notice for myself, John, I'm sure you do, when now that you think about it like this, when we are with people who, you know, socially distant, wearing masks, but we're with people that have older people who live with them, they're very careful. They're thinking now about that and the changes that it makes and into their everyday lives. And I'd like to just say that I really miss eating Chinese food. And now that you've said that, I have a taste for it and I'm going to order it in this week.
I had the very same experience. I was reading the story online last night, and then to their credit, the Tribune then said, here are the restaurants. Here's the ones that are, and a lot of them don't have outdoor eating, so they can't reopen. But those that do have indoor outdoor seating are. And there is the list of the restaurants and what they serve and how you get the food there. And I thought, what's to keep me from getting in my car and driving down to Chinatown and getting some food and patronizing one of those restaurants? They didn't deserve the derision that they suffered when this thing broke out. So I'll see you at one of those places. DraftKings, what is the status of DraftKings? I'm reading a story from CNBC about this. Have you been following this?
I have not.
Then maybe I'm showing you the wrong story. I thought that this was one of the ones we were going to talk about. I'm skipping ahead to somebody else. Fair enough. anything else then on your agenda, at least, that you want to bounce off of us on the real estate front?
I just want everybody to know that we are in full swing, even though it's the dead of summer, the spring housing market is in full swing now. So we're a little bit off with our seasons this year in real estate, but the number of homes that are being sold in the Chicago metropolitan area is at an extremely fast clip. We're seeing it in the suburbs particularly, but also in the city. There seems to just be a tremendous amount of activity, both in the residential and then in some parts of the commercial world as well. And so it's very interesting to see. This is going to easily be the hottest summer in terms of number of transactions, I think maybe ever.
So the beneficiary of that is the seller then?
The seller is definitely winning out. So sorry for all you buyers. You win out though because you've got the lowest mortgage rates in history that are still hanging around thanks to all the Federal Reserve action. And by the way, the Fed is looking to support the economy even further other than handing out dollar bills on the street. Not sure what else they're going to come up with, but it is depressing mortgage rates to the benefit of all buyers.
Yeah, right. So then do you, last thing is, have any inside on what the Congress is going to do with the stimulus checks, the $1,200, will it be $6,000 a family maximum?
That would be nice. I don't think we're going to get that far. I think what the highest number that I've heard is $2,400. So again, you know, $1,200 to you, maybe your spouse or partner that you're living with. Not even sure we're going to see stimulus checks go to kids. And there's still people who haven't gotten their stimulus checks from the first round. And so if you haven't, my suggestion to you is to contact our congressional representatives, your congressional representative in D.C. at their office where they are ready and willing to help out.
I haven't forgot I owe you a check, Elise.
John, I love that you owe me money.
Elise Glink is the real estate financial wellness expert. Visit thinkglink.com. Nice to talk to you, Elise.
You too, John.
1234, this is WGN. You know, I mentioned something about DraftKings to Elise Glink, and my producer was just walking through that detail with me, and here is just that headline. DraftKings sinks amid MLB virus outbreak. You'd think that DraftKings would be doing well with baseball coming back, but because of the news that Steve Bertrand just reported, the shares are off 7%. Shares of the online gambling company DraftKings dropped 7% today, as Major League Baseball suffered an outbreak of the coronavirus with one of its teams. There's no mention yet that the season's going to be canceled. There's no mention yet about what's going to happen with those two teams, except that, as you just heard, a couple of games are being canceled for today. What happens after that remains to be seen. But if the games aren't played, evidently less money's going to be spent on the app, and so it's off 7%, anticipating maybe the worst. To talk with Catherine Davis, Associate Editor at Chicago Inno. You can find these nice folks at chicagoinno.com. Catherine, welcome back. I trust you're well.
Hi, John. Yes, doing well. How are you?
I'm good, and I ate some good food over the weekend, and I'm looking at this story now that you guys have. In fact, you authored it the other day about delivery of food. What are you writing about here?
Yeah, so, you know, last week in Chicago there was some big news in the food delivery space because a local startup called Chowbus raised $33 million. So you think of food delivery and you're thinking of Grubhub and DoorDash and Uber Eats and how could anyone else compete in the space right now? But Chowbus has carved out a niche for itself, specializing in Asian cuisines. So interesting to see them grow. I remember we wrote about them last year, and they were much smaller, maybe in 6 cities. Now they're in 20 cities, have hundreds of restaurants working with them. And they say, you know, they've become popular because they've prioritized mom-and-pop restaurants that aren't on these other delivery apps.
Which would explain why they're maybe kind of honing down on Asian restaurants then, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I know people here in Chicago that use Chow Bus and really like it. I have yet to use it, but I'm more interested in seeing what it's like.
I just wonder, though, I mean, if you're featuring Chinese food as a type of food you'll deliver, is it not Chinese food per se, but just because those tend to be mom-and-pop operations, or is there something unique to the delivery of that kind of food that you're going to be very good at?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because they say that, you know, they focus on specific dishes rather than just restaurants. So the idea that you could go on their app and you could say, you know, hey, I'm really craving like a General Tso's chicken tonight. And it'll give you those options from local restaurants as opposed to a restaurant first approach and then choosing what you want off their menu. So I think in some ways it helps you find maybe like the best dish that's close to you. Because, you know, people can rate, of course, the dishes that they order.
Sure. Then maybe that would work for Chinese food, because if you think pizza, you don't think, I'm going to Google pizza and find out where's a pizza near me. Folks know the kind of pizza they like, and they know how to get it already. This is maybe a little different. Well, then what's this, though, about GoLogic Solutions? Can you talk a little bit about that?
So GoLogic is a TechStars company. TechStars is a local accelerator program here in Chicago. They have many programs across the world, but the one in Chicago has gotten a lot of notoriety for you know, putting out some really awesome startups. And GoLogic is, you know, basically a delivery app for just about everything. They work with restaurants. They work with grocery stores. They work with independent shoe and clothing retailers even. So, you know, they really want to be the go-to delivery app for just about everything. But because, you know, so many people are at home, avoiding catching COVID and not going to restaurants, restaurant delivery has been a big part of GoLogic's business. And, you know, the way that they're differentiating themselves is that instead of, you know, giving restaurants sort of a third-party delivery service, they're giving restaurants all of the tech that they need to facilitate deliveries themselves. So the idea is if I'm a local pizzeria owner, I can use GoLogic software, and I can use my own employees to deliver food as opposed to using a Grubhub delivery person or a DoorDash, et cetera.
That's interesting. I've called restaurants at times and tried to order food. Maybe I had another question about the food. I said, can I order? They say, go to the app or go online. And that's a little frustrating because I'm like, hey, you're the restaurant. How about I tell you, you write it down, and then I'll come pick it up or you deliver it. That seems so simple, but it's not that easy with some places anymore. If this would empower them to better do that, control the order taking and delivery of their own food, I like that even as a consumer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, from the consumer side, you still will have to download an app called Go Local. But, you know, the idea is that more restaurants will be saving money on the fees. You know, they're really only paying for the SaaS platform on a subscription basis, and it's not like, you know, the number of, the higher the deliveries, the more money is being taken from them.
Let's segue here to real estate a little bit. We were talking to Elise about renting and buying and who's in the driver's seat. There's a software out that helps landlords. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. This startup is called Avail, founded in 2012. And, you know, basically they make a software for the do-it-yourself landlord so you can do everything from screening tenants to collecting rent, managing maintenance requests. We wrote about them last week because they raised $4.2 million in a Series A round. And they said that, you know, they were able to raise this money during a pandemic because a lot of landlords are actually using their platform more often. They're onboarding more tenants and landlords because people are looking for ways to pay rent contactlessly, right? You know, doing everything digital is you know, really what COVID has brought upon for us, and Avail is sort of seeing the upsides of that.
That's a Chicago group, huh?
That's right, yep. They have more than 600,000 landlords and renters now using their platform.
You know, I saw that in your story, and when I see something like that, I think, that's amazing. I wonder, do you have any idea how many employees a company like that has? If they've reached that level of success, do they have a whole bunch of people or what?
So Avail says they only have about 30 people. So working on a pretty lean team for that many clients, right? And, you know, this is pretty normal for what we see in startup industries, just because, you know, it's usually one person that's founded it, and they're trying to grow smartly and leanly, not to overspend and to keep things on a trajectory going up.
Mm. Catherine Davis, Associate Editor at Chicago Inno. Nice to talk to you, Catherine. Thanks for your time today.
Yeah, you too, John.
12:42, time for the Wintrust Business Minute.
Wind the clock. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, your daily roundup of Chicago area business news. Walgreens says Stefano Pessina plans to step down as CEO, a move that comes as the drugstore giant faces the pandemic and bigger shifts in the pharmacy business altogether. The 79-year-old coordinated the merger between Walgreens and Alliance Boots. Have you heard of Chowbus? It's a food delivery business started by a Chinese student at Illinois Tech a few years ago, about 5 years ago. It has expanded to more than 20 markets and now just raised $33 million for more growth. And Chicago gas prices have fallen 4.3 cents a gallon in the past week to $2.46. That's according to Gas Buddy's daily survey. Gas prices in Chicago are down about 80 cents a gallon from last year. That's the Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Steve Bertrand.
Here's an agribusiness report from Orion Samuelson.
A look at prices of commodities today, showing a lot of red on my screen. The September wheat contract down 10 and 3 quarter cents a bushel. September corn trading 2 cents a bushel lower. But August soybeans are trading higher. They're up 2 cents a bushel. Not much of a price move in those commodities. Taking a look at livestock futures, Chicago Mercantile Exchange, the August lean hog contract is up 52 cents a hundredweight. The August live cattle contract down 75 cents. And the August feeder cattle contract even lower, down $1.57 a hundredweight. Looking at some pretty good news in the agricultural community, some more sales of soybeans related today by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. 132,000 tons of soybeans sold to China and 250,371 tons sold to Mexico. Speaking of selling, normally farm sales and farm equipment sales are held in the spring. That seems to be the good time to sell used farm equipment. But there's a company in Halleck, Minnesota, the Steffes Group, that held a farm machinery auction last week on Thursday. And they had 150 pieces that sold. The major event attracted 1,129 bidders. That included 220 live bidders and other 909, or 80%, online. And in all, bids added up to more than $3.5 million. That was above auction estimates, according to Scott Steffes, who is the president of the Steffes Group in Minnesota. Looking at some of the prices that were paid, the outcomes included $360,000 for a 2018 John Deere S790 combine and a 2018 John Deere 2230 field cultivator, sold for $78,000. But according to Scott Steffes, president of the company, he said tractors did well. The late model ones with low hours. We had a 2013 John Deere 8360R tractor, brought $260,000 at that auction. We have talked a lot about the cancellations this summer, county fairs, and we're into the county fair season right now, and many of them have been postponed till next year, and some of them are going virtual. And then, of course, the big shows we've already talked about, the state fairs in the Midwest and the Farm Progress Show in Boone, Iowa, the Husker Harvest Days in Grand Island, Nebraska. All of them have been either postponed or are going virtual. But I've been hearing from some of you who are curious about other big shows. The Ohio Farm Science Review will be held in London, Ohio, will be held, but it's a virtual presentation, September 22 through 24, and the 2020 Big Iron Farm Show, scheduled for West Fargo, North Dakota, September 15 through 17, and the Sunbelt Ag Expo, October 20 through 22 at Moultrie, Georgia. The New York Empire Farm Days postponed till August 3rd of 2021. And county fairs, if you're planning to go to a county fair, check the dates and the location before you go, because it will also tell you if the county fair is virtual without people and without livestock, or if it's simply postponed till next year. And summer unlike any other I've seen for the fairs and the outdoor farm shows. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
1251 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm John Williams. Pete Zimmerman is our producer. And Amy Guth, the reporter, joins us to follow up on a couple of stories. We'll get to the McDonald's story, which I think is really interesting, in a minute. But if you don't mind, let's start, Amy, with what's going on with Target. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly, John. So Target, much like Walmart did last week, has said they will not be open for Thanksgiving. A couple of things of note about that, right? So most of the retailers are saying, hey, I know that you're looking for these deals right on Thanksgiving. We promise we're going to have them a little bit earlier. But interestingly, Amazon Prime Day, which usually happens in July, has been pushed back, and Amazon said that will be later than usual this year, but they haven't set a firm date. So that kind of ups the pressure on all these big retailers to make some deals happen earlier. In fact, Target was even encouraging people to get their shopping done by October. Now, it's been a rough time for retailers, so I'm sure there's a deals in to have the best second half of the year we possibly can. But it seems like it's going to be really interesting with, you know, so much shopping happening on Amazon during the pandemic. And then these retailers going, okay, well, wait a minute. Prime has just delayed this, so maybe there's an opportunity to swoop in and grab some of that business. So I think, especially this third quarter, we're going to see a lot of interesting moves from these big retailers that people think of when they think about that end-of-the-year holiday shopping.
How do people use Amazon Prime? Is it just to swoop up some deals, or are they buying for back to school, or is there some occasion to the shopping? A lot of the occasions, I don't know that families are going to gather like they used to for Thanksgiving. Maybe Christmas is going to be downsized, fewer parties. If kids don't go back to school in the same numbers, there's going to be less back to school shopping. I wonder how much retail spending is going to happen, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot of retailers are asking themselves that question too. Like, what does back to school shopping even look like right now? And there's still a lot of questions about what back to school looks like and what school will look like in the year ahead. So, you know, I think for Amazon and retailers like that and Walmart.com, there's a big competition point right there between those two. They've really seen people shifting to kind of buying their daily goods instead of maybe on your way home you stop and grab toilet paper and OJ and things like that. Like, maybe those are coming in from online retailers now too, especially as Amazon has gotten so deep into the quicker delivery times and the grocery game and things like that. So I think it'll be really interesting. So in a blog post on its website, Target leadership said, you know, hey, we recognize that the deal hunting and holiday shopping are kind of a thing, but this isn't the year for crowds. And they really are kind of emphasizing that. And I can understand from a retail point of view, if you're thinking, oh my gosh, what is Black Friday going to be like? How am I going to keep people 6 feet apart? How am I going to make sure this isn't, you know, like a petri dish for spreading virus among each other? So I think this is, you know, a lot of retailers are kind of looking at, okay, we need to make up for a lot of lost revenue, but what do we do to keep our shoppers and our workers safe? So, again, I think it's going to be really interesting in Q3 and then into Q4 to figure out what that looks like, what back-to-school shopping, what holiday shopping for both food and gifts looks like, and then, you know, how that translates, as you said, into what holiday gatherings look like this year.
Shake up at Walgreens, speaking of retail.
Yeah, that's right. So Stefano Pessina is the CEO, and he is just a really interesting person. He is a billionaire. He lives in Monaco. His longtime partner, she is the COO of the company. He created an Italian pharmaceutical company, or a pharmacy company rather, and then orchestrated the deal between Walgreens and Alliance Boots to be Walgreens Boots Alliance. And he is stepping down. He's going to be executive chairman. And the current executive chairman, James Skinner, he's going to step down, but he's going to stay on the board to help with leadership. So in this moment that we're dealing with a pandemic and then these big shifts in the retail business, especially physical locations, and on the heels of Walgreens Boots Alliance saying they're going to have some big layoffs in the UK where they're seeing less traffic, suddenly here's a company that's looking for a leader, which is, you know, kind of unusual timing. But they're going, they put a statement out and they said they're going to start looking for that, that replacement right away. And, you know, with the two of them on the board, it, you know, all indications, you know, show that it will be a pretty smooth transition. But this kind of came out of nowhere, I feel like. This wasn't, you know, we've been talking so much about Walgreens. We've been talking so much about the moves they're making, where they are in the testing game, where they are in this moment where a lot of emphasis is on health. You know, for him to step down is a big move, and that was reflected a little bit earlier in the market. But, you know, we will see. I think a lot, there's going to be a lot of pressure on Walgreens of, like, who is that person you bring in during a pandemic and during a retail crisis to lead this huge, you know, international company.
I saw that McDonald's is requiring customers to wear masks. I hadn't been in a McDonald's, I guess, since the pandemic. I didn't know that they weren't. I was surprised that that wasn't already policy.
Yeah, that's right. I think that was the reaction of a lot of people. So Walgreens has officially said, hey, in the 14,000 U.S. stores, masks are required. They've also described in a statement some of the things they're going to be doing to protect workers and to help franchisees speed up order time. So they're going to have some kind of dividers in the back of the house, and some dividers are in cash registers, things like that. If someone does not wear a mask, they will be offered one. If they decline to use it, they will be moved to a side area. I think it looks like in many stores that's going to be kind of a designated area of like an outdoor parking lot area. And then their order will be expedited to kind of just like, let's just get this person on their way pretty quickly. I certainly hope people don't use it for that reason.
We're rewarding bad behavior, Amy.
I know, that's right. That's exactly the thought I had too. I was like, man, I hope no one abuses that. But that's what they're saying. They're saying, you know, we really are going to protect people. They've also pushed back the dining room opening. So they have already pushed that back a couple of times. And then in like June-ish, they were kind of saying, well, it's going to be state by state. But now they're just kind of saying, you know what, right now we're not approving any more openings. We're not looking at that right now. We're talking about keeping things moving forward. We're talking about keeping our workers safe, keeping customers safe, keeping things moving. You know, this is still part of this conversation where early in the pandemic, McDonald's, I meant, stripped down a lot of menu items that tended to be a little more time-consuming because they weren't ordered as often. And a lot of franchisees said, you know, I kind of like this. This is making order times go way faster. I'm getting people to the drive-thru faster. That's going to help revenue. Let's keep it this stripped down. So for now, they've decided to keep things a little more minimized. So if you've been to a McDonald's lately, you might have noticed maybe something that's not as popular that maybe you like to order is not available or something like that. That is why. So there will be some questions of what comes back and how and where after all of this is over. But for now, they're really focusing on mask usage across the board, just so it's super clear, every U.S. location, again, there's 14,000 of them, and they're making these, you know, these different procedures for back of the house to keep workers safe and to keep people moving quickly and productively. You know, and generally, like back of the house in a fast food area, it's pretty tight quarters. So these are things that will help keep workers a little, you know, give them some extra protection, but they also say, you know, but this doesn't, you know, this doesn't make it, so we don't need to use PPE. We still need to use PPE, but this is going to help protect workers and help them to keep being productive in this time.
I just have time for this headline, Amy, but you sent it our way, and I think it's a good one. Delta teams up with Lysol to innovate on travel hygiene. I think one way a lot of airlines are going to be selling their services anymore is not just great prices and destinations, but cleanliness of the cabin, right?
Absolutely. Airlines and hotels, I think we're going to see that from both of those areas a lot. So Delta has officially announced this partnership with Lysol to research and develop new solutions for these high traffic areas for in the aircraft, at the gate, all these things. And they're working with their own, like, you know, germ fighting team in house to help make, you know, Delta, a sanitary experience, and they're running out of the gate with that. So I think it'll be interesting to see how other airlines respond in the days and week ahead.
Nice to talk to you today, Amy. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thanks so much, John.